that's just messed up.
Yeah. Very realistic, though.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just like, you know, I mean, I bought it.
Again, I mean, yeah, this is a lot of this is what you kind of get, you know, with the Charles Heston version, the different parts of the ape life, you know.
Mm-hmm. We really shouldn't be referring to that as the Chuck Heston version. We really ought to be referring to that as the Frank Schaffner.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean Franklin versus Schaffner, who went on to direct Patton.
Mm-hmm.
And
win the Oscar for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He directed the original version. I mean, it's just easier to say Chuck Heston because he was in it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
he's the more prominent.
Not too many people have heard Franklin Schaffner.
Yeah.
Schaffner. So
he's the more prominent aspect of that particular film.
Chris Christopherson in the background. Being wasted yet again.
Mm-hmm. He's in Blade Trinity, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's going to be, yes.
Yeah. That's the movie that I was talking about the other day, Brian, that I downloaded a trailer to.
Yeah.
Wasn't he freaking killed in the first Blade? I mean,
I thought so, too.
Is it?
I mean, it's been a while since I've seen it, but
it's all explained in the second one.
Okay.
Have you seen the second one?
No.
See, there you go.
But that's because I didn't like the first one.
Yeah. See. So I already don't like you. Love that movie.
Well, I didn't love
don't
that
get
movie.
Me started on Wesley Snipes. I'm sorry. Don't get me started.
Well, we know him. We know him.
Anyway, we're talking about Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. We're supposed to be talking about Planet of the Apes.
look at how beautifully the makeup holds up in these scrutinizing close-ups.
Right.
These incredibly scrutinizing close-ups. I mean, that's just. It's not creepy, and it's not. It doesn't feel. Like, you know, you guys are talking about shock value. I mean, that was a big part of, you know, what made the, especially the original movie, the very first one, you know, so fresh and, you know, and entertaining. Yeah. But, you know, there's an underlying shock value to the makeup here, but, you know, it's all about, you know, great actors coming through great makeup.
Yeah,
right.
No.
You know, in the documentary, they were talking about the actors having to, you know, really overextend over accentuate, you know, how they spoke, how they, you know, kind of move their face in order to make the mask, you know, move with them.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how much they had to really do that in this movie, or you know,
well, that's part of thinking
about that.
Was the makeup upgraded enough so that, you know, they may have had to do that a little bit?
Well, I think that's part of the miracle of Rick Baker's work on this film.
Yeah.
Is that I don't think it was that much in need, you know, this time around. You watch Rick Baker talking about his work on The Grinch and everything, and how, you know, they really wanted Jim Carrey's face to come through that makeup, and that was, he was absolutely successful with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Any kind of makeup like this, you know, the Abe makeup for this movie, or the Grinch makeup for How the Grinch Stole Christmas, I mean, the only real work in that, I felt, was, you know, you know, in the application and, you know, getting into the character of it all. But I think the real miracle behind Rick Baker is that, you know, there wasn't any need for over accentuation or, you know, just overacting like it was how it was a need for the John Chambers.
Yeah, we're not saying this to diminish what John Chambers did.
No, we're not.
Or did some
amazing work. And I mean, the actors did an amazing job working with, you know, what they had to work with.
Yeah.
I mean, because you don't really notice that they're trying to work, you know, overtime in order to make that happen. You know,
yeah.
It just all kind of flows.
Imagine how beautiful she is.
Yeah, I think Lou said something about
Yeah, I wonder, did they, are those recorded sounds, or did they actually try to get the actors to?
Well, you know, I mean, I remember Tim Burton saying in his commentary that, you know, it was kind of a half joking, half serious kind of thing, but mm-hmm. he did mention that Helena Bonham Carter really got into this character and was really able to articulate a lot of the ape-like qualities that character. I mean, she would, and I mean, you're asking about sounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he was mostly joking when he mentioned this, but yeah. He said, I think, you know, Helena makes those sounds, you know, in real life anyway, you know. Given what little we know about Helena as a actual person, not just as some of the characters she's played, you know, that's why I wasn't totally shocked when I found out about her hooking up with Tim Burton. You know, right. they seem like very kindred spirits.
Right, right.
You know, I didn't question that in the least. They seem to be very kindred spirits. You know, and she seems to be somewhat on the same planet as Tim Burton. I mean, I was able to appreciate it and understand it. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm done now.
Yeah, no, I mean, her performance is probably one of the most authentic looking, besides, I guess, Bane, you know,
mm-hmm.
out of all the apes that have central parts of it.
Yeah.
And here we go.
Tim Burton still got to be Tim Burton, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, enough of Burton's sensibilities were allowed to come through in this. That's creepy.
Yeah, that's messed up.
Still, I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, these are very genuine Tim Burton moments, though.
Uh-huh.
You know, very much like, you know, and like the moment where, you know, they murders two of his officers.
Yeah.
Just, I dug moments like that. It's just because I knew that was Tim Burton coming through.
Aren't right. they the officers?
Yeah.
That was Tim Burton coming through this studio mask that we've mm-hmm. been, you know, discussing. Who's the actor playing Attar?
Oh.
I know he's Japanese. He's a Japanese actor.
Oh, wow.
Great. You know, it's there's some. I like her reaction to this glow stick.
Heston had a, I guess it was his character, but now that I've seen him in a couple of interviews, it almost seems like it's him. Had, you know, a pretty cocky
attitude.
Throughout the entire first one. I mean, does the main character in the book have the same? Does that attitude come through?
Pretty not, well? Not really. I like that character more than I did the Chuck Heston character. The character in the book, I actually enjoyed getting to know him better than I did the Chuck Heston.
I do too, but I still feel that, I mean, he's not cocky in the same way Heston was, but I still think the character in the book is cocky, at least on an intellectual level, because, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the book is basically told from his point of view,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and a lot of the scenes in the movie, in the book, are mirrored in the original movie where, mm-hmm. you know, he's trying to get to mm-hmm. speak with Zira and what have you.
Yeah.
And you know, you what you don't see in the movie, you read the book about how he's put,
how he learns
put
the
through these tests and stuff like that, and with all the humans are put through these tests, and it's like
yeah.
none of them can get, and it's like he there's a superiority complex he
well, I didn't,
gets about
I didn't,
the fact that these are so easy for him.
I read into that, but I didn't feel the
I mean,
I didn't feel the cockiness coming. I mean, I read into the superiority complex, but that was a given. I mean, you know, that's precisely how I would be reacting to anything like that myself. You know, I'm not a, you know, the thing is, I mean, I'm not an overly confident person, but that is precisely how I would be reacting to a situation such as that. You know, that's a good question, Dave. That's an
yeah.
excellent question, but I mean, I didn't read into it like that. I just read into that as, you know, that is precisely how I'd be reacting to this. I think that's precisely how anyone, you know, would be reacting to a situation like that. You know, they'd be just milking it for, you know, they're in this totally precarious situation where, you know, nothing makes sense, you know, and if the only thing that made any sense was, if the only thing that made any sense was, you know, being able to, react to, you know, various tests, you know, and be able to perform them without any, you know,
mm-hmm.
without even flinching, you know. I mean, I would just, that's why I liked the character in the book that much more than I did the Chuck Heston character, just because he was that much more of an everyman, in my opinion.
Right. I, you know, what made me kind of think of that was the fact that Mark Wahlberg, I don't know if it's him or if it's him trying to, you know, play that part, you know, seems to have that same type of cockiness. This seems to kind of be probably his, like, ideal character to play.
I think it's a little bit both.
I really did feel, now that we're analyzing it, I feel as if Mark Wahlberg's character is close to the character in the book, because very much like Tim Burton discusses in his commentary, you know, he wanted someone who would react to this in a way that was more or less nothing like the Chuck Heston character, because to listen to Tim Burton analyze it is pretty interesting, because he was looking at this character as someone who is saying, what the hell's going on here? How in the world can I get out of this? You know, and not, you know, and not, you know, he wasn't, you know, because Chuck Heston's character was seemed much more like, you know, he was in it for the, you know, for the glory of it all, which, you know, which is not, which is what weren't, that wasn't the intention.
Mm-hmm.
But if you listen to Tim Burton describe his philosophy on how this character should have been approached, I think it was much closer to the way he and Mark Wahlberg decided to do it, you know, like it was in the book, than it was done with the Frank Chapman film. You know, it wasn't meant to be, you know, well, here I am, where are all the chicks, and, you know, where's all the glory, you know, which I've, you know, that wasn't the intention of the Chuck Heston character, but, you know, it seemed more like that than it did with this version. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
no, it does.
That's the way I felt. I felt as if this character was in that way closer to the character in the book.
Okay. That's, you know, he just mentioned the scientific experiments, and that's what you were seeing a lot of in the original version. This whole using humans for experiments, and the whole thing is based around sort of a lab, you know. And you don't really see that in this one. They concentrate more on the humans and slavery aspect of, you
mm-hmm.
know, than human experimentation.
Yeah, and you see it a whole lot more in the Pierre Boulle novel.
Okay.
Than, I mean. Yeah, you do see it in the Heston version, in the Franklin Schaffner film, but you see it even more in the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really go into some of the logistics and of and what have you.
What about the sort of religious aspect of things in the book?
You know, I think the religious aspect is in the book is much more touched on. I really did feel as if the religious aspect of the story was in the book was much closer in the Tim Burton version. That was my.
I mean, the whole religious aspect of it. The way
it was dealt with in the book, I thought was much. I thought it was much closer. The way it was dealt with in the Tim Burton version was much closer to the book than it was in the Chuck Heston version.
Yeah.
And you know the entire idea of the fact that chimpanzees, you know, in particular, don't believe necessarily in a higher power, and that you know a lot, you know, it's more the orangutans and the gorillas that adhere to those beliefs than the chimpanzees do because supposedly they're more educated.
Yeah.
But you know what? There's less racial, you know, it's obviously dealt with the human aspect, but there's less racial, there are far fewer racial aspects dealt with, you know, the apes. Because, mm-hmm. you know, like in the Franklin Schaffner film, you know, all the gorillas are the soldiers and the chimpanzees are the scientists and the orangutans are the, you know, the high society, you know, socialites, you know, and everything. And it's much more diverse than the Tim Burton version, which I really did like.
Yeah.
Was able to appreciate it. But we're talking over Charlton Heston's cameo here.
Yeah.
Which, I liked his performance, but the ape makeup, his makeup almost always threw me off.
Really?
He didn't. I never felt like.
Well,
he
was supposed to be an older ape.
Yeah.
I mean, he's on his deathbed for crying out loud. I mean.
But I just didn't buy it as much. I mean, you know, it's still fantastic. You know, Rick Baker. but I don't know. I just didn't feel as if he looked as much like a chimpanzee as Tim Roth did, and you know. But I mean, still, it's a really great cameo. I mean, it really is one of the great cameos, I think, just because you know it's Chuck Heston, and you know, I mean, it's a wonderful nod to the original movie, and I enjoy it, and like Tim Burton says in his commentary, to like hear him say that one line is worth my price of admission right there, you know. And there isn't really much of a, you know, it's referred to as Kali Ma in the Tim Burton movie. It's referred to as the Forbidden Zone in the Chuck Heston movie. But that concept isn't really dealt with in the novel as much. It seems as if it's really just something that's like,
but
which I thought was interesting.
Well,
the thing is,
I mean, that's one of the places where the book and both versions of the movie are on completely different ground.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, because you don't have...
Nor were the scarecrows. I was looking for the scarecrows in the novel when I was reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I really did think that was going to be an essential part of the book, seeing as how it was, you know, in both movies. And I thought that was really was expecting them to show up somewhere, but they weren't. That was just something else that wasn't in the book that I was kind of surprised by. But you know, at the same time, I was glad to see some differences, just because it made the book worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that was one of the things that made one of the many things that made the book worth taking a look at was were the differences and being able to point those out.
And one of the things that's really extraordinary is, I mean, for some reason, I always understood that the Tim Burton version was going to adhere closer to the novel
mm-hmm.
than the Chuck Heston version did. But when you read the book, it's actually the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Chuck Heston version is closer to the book, and Tim Burton's film is exactly what they say it is, and it's a reimagining.
Right.
Because there are a whole, there's a boatload of differences between this and the book and the original movie, so. But that's one of the things that I like about it.
But, you know, there is some very subtle subtext.
Yeah.
Including you know, that's in the Tim Burton version that is, in fact, from the novel.
Uh-huh.
Including the talk of religion and you know, whatnot. That's such a cheese ball line.
Which one? The
Seymour smiles on me. I would. No, and there's my favorite one is coming up. My favorite one is right here. If they come this way, we will crush them. Such a campy line. And you know, you see Michael Clark Duncan in some of the extras, and he just looks like a little kid in a candy shop. He's having an absolute ball with this role.
Yeah,
I mean, he looks like he was the actor had the most fun on this project.
Michael Clark Duncan from
The Green Mile,
and Daredevil, and The Whole Nine Yards. What was the one you said? What did you just say?
You just said
No, I said great performance.
Oh, you
said Green Mile.
Yeah. I had no idea riding a horse was this easy.
I think it's a little more complicated than that. But
and they talk about in the show the gorillas trying to outrun the horses. You know, saying that you know, that they could outrun a horse if necessary. At least that's what I read in an interview.
I remember reading Danny Elfman was under somewhat of a amount of pressure to make the themes more heroic than you might be used to from him.
Mm.
Just because the studio wanted to market this as a Tim Burton Gladiator kind of deal. And I'm sure that wasn't the, you know, I mean, this was above all else, a remake of the, you know, the original 1968 film. But like, I thought that was interesting when I read Danny Elfman's interview for Film Score Monthly, and just what, you know, I mean, because this was his and Tim Burton's biggest studio project to date, and you know, I mean, I remember listening to Tim Burton in his Big Fish commentary and mentioning how relieved he was to work on, you know, a much smaller project, a much more intimate and personal project like Big Fish, mm-hmm. after, you know, working on such an enormous studio project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, I mean, but when I read that, like, that, you know, Danny Elfman was under pressure by the studio to make some of the themes more heroic and less Danny Elfman-esque, you know, I mean, that was, I just thought it was kind of amusing.
Well, it's kind of amusing when you take into consideration Batman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, few themes are more heroic than that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
you know, and at the same time, he, you know, it was a very heroic theme, but at the exact same time, he still got to be Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
He still got to remain, you know, true to, you know, his and Tim Burton's vision.
Yeah.
Can I just say I'm just really glad that we were able to, you know, find, you know, because I remember Tim Burton mentioning this in the commentary that, you know, he didn't believe in tripping horses, and that's why that one moment looks as, you know, looks as disingenuous as it does. I'm just so glad that we've now come up with the concept of computer generated horses, like we got to see in Return of the King, where
yeah.
we actually get to see, you know, horse, because yeah, this is probably one of the more flat moments, I think, in the film. You know, it's not very, you know, it's not the most
interesting. Well, I mean, the thing is, it's not the big action scene.
Right.
I mean, it's not the big action scene. You know that's on the way. I mean, so.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
and even the big action scene, you know, I was not particularly impressed with the way the action was staged in this movie. I actually thought it was more interesting in the Franklin Schaffner film,
mm-hmm.
the way the action was staged. I really did think as if I really did walk away with this, you know, the action aspect of this movie anyway, is feeling as if, you know, the filmmakers just felt it was more of a chore, you know, to stage the action. And you know, you listen to Danny Elfman's commentary, and he talks about how much of a chore it is for him to, you know, score an action sequence. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not entirely sure how interested Tim Burton is in action in his films. You know, if you look at, I mean, it's a little bit more prominent in Batman Returns, but when you look at the original Batman, you know, it's not as much about the action as it is about the characters, and
yeah.
you know, I mean, I just wasn't as impressed, you know. And the thing is, there wasn't that much action in the novel.
No,
you know,
no, not at all.
It was more about the characters and the story than it was about
yeah.
you know, the action and the adventure aspect.
Mm.
It's still very much a science fiction novel, which I was able to appreciate, but
yeah.
And this is what's fondly referred to by the filmmakers, you know, both the Tim Burton commentary and the Danny Elfman commentary enjoy referring to this as the ape shit moment, which I thought I got a kick out of hearing that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a little weird.
I like the
feeling of I guess fear that I was supposed to feel, like it was really
this character scares the crap out of me every time I watch this movie. I mean, he really does.
I mean, the rest of his performances, you know, within this movie are great. It's just, you know, this little anger scene though didn't seem to do the type of respect to the rest of the scenes, you know, of the character being, you know, as dark as he is. That little going crazy didn't seem to respect that.
That worked for me, though. I mean, it worked for me. I mean,
yeah, they could have chose something a little bit better, I think. Just, you know, for me, than him jumping up and down a couple walls and, you know, chopping off a lamp to really make his anger known. Considering this is the man who just, like, killed two of his own soldiers in cold blood
mm-hmm.
and talks like he's crazy, you know.
Yeah. Well, he also just lost his father too.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah
I
yeah.
think that's part of it.
Yeah. That's part too. You know, so I was.
I, which
I mean, you know, so that's even more devastating. So, you know, I was kind of hoping for something more.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this whole their party, kind of, you know, fighting their way back thing. That whole part of the movie is kind of flat for me. You know,
mm-hmm.
and I mean the little thing that we got of Thane right there was, even though I didn't like it that much, was immensely more interesting to me than this. In some ways, I mean, you know, we're getting some character development and that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, but it just doesn't quite seem to be that great. But I mean, if anybody's carrying it along, it's her. You know, she's doing
mm-hmm.
a fantastic job.
Mm-hmm. You know, this could have very easily been a real cheese ball moment where, you know, it's, you know, she could have played it like a 10-year-old girl, just, you know, when I was a little girl, I used to look up in the stars and dream about a better life, you know, and that's, you know, it could have very easily been played like that, but she was so truthful in this role that, you know, I fell for it, you know, hook, line, sinker, so, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
That's another testament to Helena's performance. She just played it very truthfully, and I really did admire that about it.
Yeah.
Captivated.
Well, you know, it's
captivated.
I'm sorry. I just, you know.
I was captivated by her running away like that. For me, that was captivating.
You know, dare I say, I just think I just admire her performance a lot more than I've liked a lot of other, you know, Hollywood beauty roles. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I just have such a hard time. I know I'll stop talking about this, but after I'm done here, but I just usually just have such a hard time buying so many of those roles and performances that, you know, it's just refreshing to see a role come through like that with that kind of vulnerability.
Mm.
I mean, I do not mean to place that much emphasis on this small role. I mean, because her role is small and it's, you know, it's not meant to be overstated. It's, you know, I just appreciate it for its ability to, you know, come in under the radar and, you know, and you know, capture my attention without, you know. I'm going to shut up about that though now because I mean, I've said way too much.
Another tirade.
No, you don't want another one of those from me. No. I love the exterior.
Yeah.
There. That's
oh, yeah, that does look fantastic.
Yeah. I love the exterior of this location and the interior as well.
Right.
It's really well done. Some really wonderful set design here. And
yeah, boy, this is your place. Yeah, she blew up.
Yeah.
Sweet damn. Ooh, that was your girl.
To be or not to be? Sorry.
I knew him well.
Sorry. You know, the whole Forbidden Zone and the whole geography.
Which isn't in the book, by the way. Did I mention I read the book? I'm just absolutely proud of the fact that I read the book. I'm sorry.
He's proud that he read the book, ladies and gentlemen. Wow.
I mean, I didn't get to talk about the book once during Lord of the Rings, so I'm just totally proud of the fact that I've actually read a book. So I'm just going to milk that for all it's worth.
You hear that, ladies? He's proud they read a book.
Because I never got to make one book reference during Lord of the Rings, so I get to. I'm just.
You
gonna,
did. You were just speculating about them.
Yeah.
I mean.
So I'm just gonna milk that for all it's worth.
Milk that.
Brian, you remember this chapter in the book where you get some backstory? You know. It's a completely different situation.
But yeah.
It's somewhat similar at the exact same time. It's probably the most challenging. It's probably the most challenging chapter in the book to read and to understand.
I mean,
did you get what I meant though when I was discussing the similarities with you earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I do kind of get it.
It's just a very challenging read in the book, this one particular chapter. It's like the third to last, where you actually get some exposition to how the planet of the apes, where its origins lie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, you really would just have to read the book to understand precisely where the author was coming from as far as, you know, how he wanted to explain the origins.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's similar, but it isn't. You know, and
yeah.
I mean, that's why I encourage, you know, Dave to read the book. I mean, because I think he would. You know, I know Dave's just a big fan of science fiction and fantasy books, fantasy in particular. But you know, I know he would enjoy this particular read. I like this moment too. I'm just a fan of the really dark moments. So, Brian, the humans talking versus the humans not talking.
Which do I prefer?
Yeah.
It's much more intriguing if they don't talk. Because
mm-hmm.
you wonder what happened.
Yeah.
And I like kind of finding out, you know, for that, you know, as much as you do in the book and the, not so much in the Chuck, in the movies.
Right, yeah, that's what I was saying.
But, in the book, I like sort of finding out what happened. You know, sort of trying to figure out what happened, why they can't speak.
Right.
I kind of like that. And, you know, I mean, I don't have a problem with them talking in this version, but, you know, it fits the story,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
yeah.
a very different story
exactly.
from the original movie and the book, so. See, we can't help ourselves with the stupid questions.
You
at least stop yourself.
And I seem not to be able to help myself with the stupid statements, but I try to refrain.
See, is he going to lead him? Is he not going to lead him?
Well, see, that was, you know, I mean, you know, there was some conflict with the Chuck Hessen character, but then again, there really wasn't nearly as much with that character as I felt there was with the Mark Wahlberg character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the internal conflict.
Oh,
of,
yeah.
Is this my destiny to lead the humans in a revolt, or is it not? You know, and
well, they don't really deal with the sense of destiny in the Chuck Hessen movie
mm-hmm.
either.
But you know that is a part of the subtext though, of the film anyway. And, you know, it's touched on in the. Are we doing okay over there?
Yeah.
Okay. It's touched on in the 35th anniversary DVD for, you know, the Chuck Hessen version was released not too long ago, and there's a really interesting text commentary on there that discusses how Hessen just got a kick out of the fact that, you know, his character was somebody who more or less despised the human race, and
yeah.
he felt as if, you know, he knew that there was something better out there. And I just remember reading the text commentary for that DVD, you know, the 35th anniversary edition, that he got a kick out of the fact that he was once somebody who despised the human race, but turned out to be their sole defender,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he just...
Yeah, and I have to say, I do like that sort of contradiction in his personality, where he's very cynical about the human race, and yet he almost shows a certain amount of, sorrow for what happened,
mm-hmm.
what ended up happening at the end of that movie, which we probably could say out loud and will not get stoned, since most people know what it is anyway, but...
Yeah, I'm sensing on the back of the
Yeah.
Wait, what happens at the end of the Chuck Hessen movie? What happens, Brian?
A startling revelation.
Really?
That's all.
Well, I guess I have to see that movie.
That's all I really care to say.
Well, I guess I have to see that movie then, huh?
Yes, it's a great movie.
Yeah. Not as good as Escape from Planet Apes.
So says you.
I don't necessarily, which is kind of unfortunate, I don't necessarily see this film turning into a franchise, which is...
And see, that's the thing. It's like, I was really anxious to see it happen.
So was I.
After seeing this. Of
yeah,
course, I will have only wanted Tim Burton doing it.
Right. Which, but that wasn't going to
happen. Yeah,
that
wasn't
going to
happen.
And I know Tim Roth, and both Tim Roth and Mark Wahlberg weren't going to do a sequel unless Tim Burton
uh-huh.
agreed. agreed to it, and that's probably obviously not going to happen, which is really unfortunate because, I mean,
you could
go so many places with this franchise just as it was done with the original franchise, and you know the potential is limitless.
Yeah.
And so are we going to see a second one? Or a third
as
one?
Of now, no.
Yes. And I mean,
which is really too bad.
That's really a shame. Considering how it was left, like you're saying, Ron. I mean, that's really a shame.
Mm-hmm.
I like this scene.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We haven't, I mean, we've talked about Danny Elfman. We haven't really talked about our feelings of Danny Elfman's score versus Jerry Goldsmith's score for the original.
Well, you know, that's actually really, that's touched on in an interview Danny Elfman did for Film Score Monthly, that, he makes it absolutely clear that, you know, he wasn't looking to, he really wasn't looking to really necessarily pay homage to Jerry Goldsmith's score as much as he was. He was, because these are two very different films, and, and two very different composers. I mean, both very accomplished and both very much worthy of notoriety. But Danny Elfman was not looking to imitate or pay homage, to Jerry Goldsmith's score.
Should he have?
No, he wanted to be fresh, but he wanted it to be as original as as Jerry Goldsmith's score, but
which I think he succeeded.
Yeah, but he also knew from the beginning that this score was going to be much more traditional.
Yeah, right.
And those are his exact words, that he knew from the start, given the reimagining of the story and given the studio's aspect and giving, his longtime collaboration with Tim Burton, he knew that this was going to be just a much more traditional score, and it's still very fresh and still very, very much just a really great Danny Elfman score.
I mean, I could now, see one of his better ones.
It is. And now, did Jerry Goldsmith did not win the Oscar for Planet of the Apes?
He was nominated, but he did not win.
Did he not? I was totally under the impression that he had one.
No.
But